Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of Press X for Story. I am your host, Will, aka Can't Wear Hats, and today I'll be talking with my guest about a game that a lot of people like and is kind of a nostalgic game for a lot of people. It is Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time. And my guest, in fact, is, you know, nostalgia, I think, is the right word for this game, because my guest is my brother. It's Scott.
Hi, hello.
Welcome.
Good to be here.
So yeah, my brother Scott, and we're going to talk about Ocarina of Time.
Indeed.
And before we start out, actually, I should mention that, look, okay, Zelda, a lot of people like a lot of different Zelda games. We're not trying to say that Ocarina of Time is the best.
Even though it is, secretly.
Shh, don't tell anyone. But like, not like objectively, whatever. Art is subjective, okay?
Apart from when it's objective, because this is the best one.
Look, I'm trying to do a thing here.
I know.
The point is, we like Ocarina of Time a lot. It is a very nostalgic game for us, and you know, we have a lot of fondness for it. You may disagree, you may prefer Link to the Past, Wind Waker, that's fine, that's all good. We're talking about Ocarina of Time today, and also kind of Zelda's history somewhat.
Kind of the history of Zelda in relation to narrative. Obviously, Press X for story, we're talking about story here. Zelda, despite what some people might say, is full of it.
It is. And actually, before we get started, I'll say this podcast, me and you talking about Zelda, is something I've wanted to do for a while.
Absolutely, yeah.
You actually, let's give a bit of background. You studied at university, what was it, game design and
art? It was game 3D game art. So it was focused mostly on the art aspect of game design, modeling, like texture creation, sure, character creation, that kind of thing. But I did a lot of academic writing as well. That was part of our degree. So I did a lot of essays about narrative in games. I wrote an essay on Zelda. I wrote my dissertation on the role of the player character in narrative storytelling in games. So this is very much my jam.
Yeah, you can see why I wanted to get him on. It's like, okay, we've got to get you on here. We've got to get in here.
Because I can go for hours on this stuff. So
that's the thing. If I ever run out of, you know, topics or people, I'll be like, Scott, get in here. We need to podcast.
Exactly.
So yeah, and it only took me two episodes to get somebody who knows what they're talking about. No, that's not fair. That's not fair.
I've got qualifications that say I know.
You can point at it and be like, look there. See, yeah. You can't argue with that.
Exactly.
Anyway, so yeah, we've wanted to do this for a while, so we're finally sitting down to record it. So I'm looking forward to this. We were doing like the setup for this and already we're talking through a lot of notes and stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah, let's talk about, I mean, Ocarina of Time, first of all, is like, it's kind of the big Zelda game. It was a big deal.
It completely redefined Zelda.
Yeah.
Forever. Like, you look at that switch to 3D. In every game, you know, you look at Mario, it's the same. But Zelda, it went from, you know, the Game Boy games and, like, Link to the Past style top-down like that to suddenly 3D with cutscenes and, like, more characterization. You had, like, full-on animation. It's a crazy big change, and it really made an impact on everyone.
Yeah, like, whether or not, you know, it's your favourite game, it undoubtedly changed the landscape, like, hugely.
I mean, it gave backstory to Hyrule. You know, it set up the whole things with the goddesses and the theology of Zelda in a way. It gave a ton of info, a ton of story, as well as being the first one in a 3D space.
Because before that, like, you had, you know, the original Zelda game, you know, top down NES.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we can start out by talking about the history of the Zelda games, specifically the narrative history, because top down, you know, original Zelda is one of those games, like a lot of NES games at the time, like, the story was mostly in the, you know, the instruction booklet.
Yeah.
It wasn't really presented in the game. The game was mostly different screens to kill monsters.
You had the opening scroll of this is the story, and then the ending scroll of this is what happened.
Yeah.
And in between that, there was nothing.
I mean, the most you really got was, it's dangerous to go alone, take this, have a sword.
But then you're thrust upon the original ideal of Zelda, which is exploring an expansive fantasy world, finding new places, and, you know, in the process of that, getting to the end goal, which is saving Princess Zelda and Triforce, and defeating Ganon. The bread and butter of Zelda is there from the get-go.
It's also kind of the bread and butter of RPGs as a whole. Like, a lot of games now, that basic formula of like, here's a world, go explore, find stuff,
yeah,
is in so many games now.
Yeah, back in that day, what, in like 1985, 86?
Yeah. Yeah.
It was, we don't know what to do with story in games.
No, like, games are a really young medium in comparison. And so in the 80s, they were still, and they kind of still are, figuring it out.
I mean,
especially now.
I mean, you look at the difference between Zelda 1 and Zelda 2. Like, you went from top-down Zelda that you know, we would know for a long time, to side-scrolling Zelda with more RPG elements, like some more conversations, NPCs, villages. Like, they clearly wanted to do more with the story, but they were still figuring things out, trying out new ideas. And then they went back from there. They went back to, you know, at least the past, and you had those elements back into the top-down view that, you know, we got used to. And that's why so many people love A Link to the Past, because they figured it out by then.
Yeah, they perfected kind of the top-down 2D formula, because there have been other top-down, you know, 2D Zelda games after that, things like Minish Cap, Oracle of Ages, Oracle of Seasons, and they all basically follow the formula of Link to the Past.
Well, yeah. They,
to an extent.
Yeah, they follow the gameplay formula. They play around with mechanics, and they play around with the story ideas and stuff, but from a basic perspective, you know, they look like Link to the Past. Not everything looks like the original Zelda, but everything post that looks like Link to the Past, if it's, you know, that kind of 2D art style.
Yeah. So, but then, you know, you've got Ocarina of Time comes out, and it's 3D. It's a huge shift, like we said.
Absolutely.
And suddenly Link to the Past did start telling stories more. So did, you know, Adventure of Link.
Yeah.
But now with cutscenes, and like 3D cutscenes, you can add extra tools to tell that story.
Yeah, suddenly it starts to feel more like a movie. That's kind of what that 3D era ushered in was, you know, they had already had it in adventure games on the PC, and suddenly 3D games could be animated to that degree where they could become more movie-like. Yeah, it worked for some, it didn't work for others. You know, you had the prevalence of cutscenes taking up hours and hours and hours at the far end of that. Whereas Ocarina of Time, you know, you had your choice ones of, you know, the dream sequence at the beginning.
I remember that very clearly.
The story of the goddesses from the Deku Tree. Like, all of these things, you know, you didn't need to have control because it was explaining to you what was going on.
A lot of it, like, with the goddesses and stuff, it was backstory that you weren't there for. Weren't present.
No.
Link wasn't present.
No one was present.
No one was there, apart from the cameraman, who was like, aha, I see.
Yeah. But even then, with those story elements, I mean, you look at like the dream sequence at the beginning, it sets up a mystery. You don't know any of these characters.
Yeah.
The first thing you see is a weird guy on horseback at night, the screaming princess that you assume is Zelda, because, you know,
Legend of Zelda.
Yeah, yeah. But you don't know what's going on. Link doesn't know what's going on. He's confused. You're confused. Immediately, you start to resonate with this, you know, with this character of the boy.
neither of you know what's happening.
Because neither of you know what's happening. And then you get thrust into, like, oh, I'm in Kokiri Village. And suddenly, it kind of takes away that mystery a little bit and goes, figure out the game.
Yeah. What's interesting, so I'm trying to think back of the cutscenes in Ocarina of Time.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure almost all of them, if not all of them, are from Link's perspective or are something he's being told.
Usually, they are usually either from his perspective or focused on him, or they are, you know, backstory.
Yeah, it's like when, I think it's one of the sages explains the goddesses or something.
Or Zelda is explaining about Ganondorf or...
Yeah, and that's backstory that's being explained to Link.
Yeah.
Because we talked about this to reference back to the first podcast about Deus Ex Mankind Divided.
Yeah.
At the end of that, there's a cutscene in which you, as the player, see something that Adam Jensen is not present for.
Right, yes.
And it's a spoiler. Like, it reveals something about a character.
Yeah.
And it's at the end of the game, so it doesn't affect it, but, like, you know something the character doesn't. That's a problem.
Yeah, that is. It becomes that old adage of tabletop role-playing, of character knowledge versus player knowledge.
Yeah, exactly. And in Zelda, certainly in Ocarina of Time, I'm fairly sure, like, correct me if I'm wrong, but, like, that doesn't really happen.
No, it's all... You never know anything more than the character would know. It's all, you know, presented to you from Link's perspective. You never get, like, oh, by the way, here's what's going on, but, you know, we're telling you separately. Yeah. From, like, it's all, you know, in the world. It's all diegetic. If you want to start throwing in some good words here.
We did use that in the first podcast. I brought that up because, yeah, and as a reminder, diegetic is something that is presented as, you know, within the world of the game.
Mm. I mean, like, whilst the cutscenes are separate from your gameplay, they are within the world. Even when you're going off and talking about the goddesses, you know, and doing a flashback, it's presented as the Deku Tree telling you about this.
Right, yeah, yeah. Because something for, you know, a more easily grokkable or understandable example, like diegetic music is music that's playing on the radio on the table in front of your character. Non-diegetic music is a soundtrack.
If, for instance, in Ocarina of Time, you've got the windmill music man. The epitome of diegetic music. Exactly.
Ad nauseum. And, well, actually, not to sidetrack from narrative, but, I mean, music plays a big part in the narrative Ocarina. It's called Ocarina of Time.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, you look at the music in those games, and part of what makes music so great is that it induces emotional responses in people.
Yeah.
And a good narrative, be it a game or a film, uses music to enhance those emotions and to bring emotions to the forefront. You know, you can switch the music in a scene and it completely changes the feel of the scene.
So, actually, let's skip back a bit, because when I was talking about the nature of the cutscene, you know, never really changing from Link's perspective.
Yeah.
That's the kind of thing that is necessary, or at least helpful to, you know, link you as the player to that character.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's a big thing in games when it comes to trying to connect the player to the player character in the story. I mean, it's a huge problem with, like, you know, you get ludonarrative dissonance, something that is came about in the big way from people talking about Uncharted, where you're playing as Nathan Drake, this happy-go-lucky chappy who's just making quips but then murdering hundreds of people. And it doesn't feel right because you think of him as this way, but you're doing something else differently. Whereas in something like Zelda, you're presented at every point, like, through, like, Link's progression up to his becoming the hero. He doesn't start off as a badass, you know? He starts off as a kid. And you learn about swordplay, and you learn about, like, all the problems in the world, and eventually you become, you know, through that hero's journey, become the hero, and at every point in that step, Link's actions make sense.
Yeah, it's also, the game doesn't try to tell you one thing about Link and then let you ignore that.
No, exactly. Like, well, in a way, it's easy to do that, because Link, you can, from one side, you could see Link as not much of a character. He doesn't have any voice, you know, voiceover. He doesn't have any even text lines. He never speaks, rather than, you know, hey, yeah, you know, he's almost like the definition of a self-insert silent protagonist. But,
well, kind of,
yeah,
not quite, yeah.
Exactly. Like, this is the point I wanted to get to, was that that is actually kind of misses the point of Link as a character, because although the story is set, you can't change what happens to Link during you know, the story. You have to hit those beats. It's a linear story,
you know, no branching paths, no choose your ending, none of that.
The actions of the character in the game world define the character, like the character's traits. Thus, it's a symbiotic relationship between the player and the player character. Your actions in the game world, playing the game, are what define the character. Link is a hero because you beat the boss. I mean, Link saved the princess.
It's kind of the definition of actions speak louder than words, because he doesn't say anything.
Yeah, exactly. But even though it's, you know, you beat the princess, you would refer to yourself as, like, you know, oh, I beat the boss in Zelda. But then if someone asked you the story of Zelda, you'd say, well, Link is a little boy and then Link saves the princess. It's not you saving the princess, it's still Link. You are Link in the game. You are playing as the character of Link. You're in a sense role playing Link, even though you don't have any narrative agency. You are pretending. It's the story of Link. At the end of the day, Link is the person that saves the princess. You're not defining yourself as that character. Even though you can rename him, you shouldn't rename him. Like, just call it Link.
Well, it's interesting that they even let you do that.
I know, yeah.
I mean, part of that seems to be a mechanical thing of having different save files.
Yes, for sure.
But they refer to your character as the name. It's kind of a bit of a, it feels like a misstep, really.
Yeah.
For that game. I mean, you can do it in all the Zelda games where you get to name. It happened in Link to the Past as well.
Yeah, I mean, one thing, I mean, even from that is the name of Link. A character named Link. Who's called Link? No one's called Link. Zelda is a name. Zelda already exists as a
Yeah,
as
funnily
a name.
Enough, it actually is like an existing name.
But
yep.
Link isn't really a name. But if you think of it in the context, Link is the link between the player and Hyrule. You know, he makes, essentially forms a bridge between you playing the game and the narrative of the game and the game world. So there might be some little trickery going on in that name, because he's linking you to the world. He's allowing you to experience it.
I mean, even if that's not intentional, that's, you know, that's still a conclusion you can draw.
I mean, yeah, exactly.
It's a one interpretation. Yeah.
You know, any good narrative driven game that has a player character does that to some extent. You know, the character acts as a link between the player and the world.
A link between worlds?
Oh, yes. Aye. Exactly.
Like the game.
Exactly. But yeah. Zelda is the first time, I think for me personally, it's the first time I ever experienced that to such a degree.
Because I wanted, like, to give our personal history. Like, the first console we ever had in the house was an N64.
Yeah.
And we were around the age where it would have made sense for us to have a SNES.
Yeah.
We were just at the end of that.
Yeah, we just kind of hit that tail end.
But N64 was first, and we had, like, GoldenEye and Mario Kart and Ocarina of Time.
I remember we got it that Christmas with Zelda and Banjo-Kazooie, and Zelda, immediately just running around the world in Zelda. You know, we had no idea what we were doing. I was 8. I had no idea what.
Yeah, I was 10. I'm not much better. Like, yeah. I don't know. Hit the thing with the sword. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. It was very much that formative experience of being drawn into a world and just wanting to explore it. Because at the end of the day, that's what I ended up doing. I rarely played the dungeons. I just wanted to run around Hyrule and see all the different bits of it. And that kind of gets back to what I wanted to talk about in terms of the exploration of Zelda and how that links to the story. Because there is this thing in Zelda, or actually in all game design, called environmental storytelling.
Yes. Love a bit of environmental storytelling.
And for those who don't know, it's where the level design and the art design of an area informs the narrative and is informed by the narrative. So I'm going to take the classic example of Kokiri Village, the first thing you ever experience for yourself as a player in Ocarina of Time. And it is designed in a very, very specific way to give you a specific feeling. And that's part of environmental storytelling, is using the environment and the art design and the level design to give the player a feeling. And in the Kokiri Forest, there's a couple of things it's doing. It's, for one, it's invoking classical fairy tales. There's a best friend fairy, there's lost children in the middle of a big expansive woodlands, the children's village. It's a very kind of like classic fairy tale tropes thrown in there. But just from the art design, you know, you've got the kind of little fireflies floating about, magical sparkles with Na'vi. Everyone's got their own fairy. People are dressed up like Peter Pan.
They are. And it's lit. It's like bright sunlight.
Yeah.
Bright colours, green.
Green in art design is a very friendly colour. It's kind of nature. It's, you know, you see trees. It feels somewhere where children would be safe. You know, it's got these high walls. You look at Kokiri Village, it's got these really high walls around it with trees going up, you know, to the skyline. And that makes it feel safe. It feels enclosed. You know, you can't leave. That's the whole thing, is you're not allowed to leave. Children aren't allowed to leave. No one's allowed in. It's this enclosed space that is like a safe space for these kids to live. And that's a perfect place to start off the very first 3D Zelda, because you're going to be getting used to it. No one's experienced Zelda in 3D before, so here's a safe space in which you can play about. They're not pushing you into anything dangerous. You can run around that village for as long as you want and get used to the controls. You know, you go through the tutorials. They aren't really tutorials, they're part of the game. You know, you're talking to characters and they give you a little bit of a hint. You know, it makes you feel safe so that when you go into the Deku Tree, it's a very different thing. Suddenly you're presented with this dark, brooding, kind of grimy space with haunting music and spider webs and cobwebs, and you feel that danger immediately. you're like, I don't want to be here.
Yeah, this isn't good.
You know, you've come from a happy-go-lucky village of forest children to spiders and cobwebs and angry plants that want
to
eat you.
And the Deku Tree is like, no, you have to do this.
Yeah.
You can't say no.
Yeah.
Because the dialogue is like, you know, are you ready? And you can say no, and Deku Tree's like, but thou must.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, well, I guess I can't say no to this.
You're not given much of a choice. This is where you need to go. And it is, you know, every aspect of that play space when you get inside the Deku Tree informs this idea of things are bad. That world you thought you knew when you entered the village for the first time, that's not the world. That's just that. The real world is a mess.
We may get into this later, but like Ocarina of Time, I mean, is in many ways literally and also textually like it's a coming of age story.
Absolutely, yeah.
But just that little microcosm in Kokiri Forest,
yeah,
is also like a tiny little coming of age, because you're like, well, I'm gonna go to the Deku Tree. Oh, things are bigger than I knew. Things are a lot worse than I realized.
I mean, even if you look back at the Lost Woods, you know, because you can go in there when you still haven't done anything and kind of explore about, and it's a very kind of scary place again, because, you know, you get lost, you get turned around. You're not meant to feel good in there. It's supposed to be kind of an exploration challenge. And again, like, it feels enclosed. There's kind of these dark spaces, high walls, small little areas. It doesn't feel nice and safe like Kokiri Village does, and because it isn't. You know, there are places you can walk into there and get hurt. And I think one of the biggest things in Zelda for me, in Ocarina of Time, is that first step outside of the forest. You know, after you've beaten the Deku Tree, you have to say goodbye to Saria. You know, it's a big emotional moment for the character. You know, even that little cutscene on the bridge is a great little cutscene, because Link is scared. Link doesn't want to say goodbye. He doesn't want to deal with these emotions. He runs away. Kind of telling of this naive little character that's still growing.
Yeah. I remember for me playing it, like, when you step out, like you said, and you see Hyrule Field for the first time. It's interesting, because when you come out, you're still surrounded by high walls until you get to the end of that little corridor bit. And you get there, and there's no walls. It's just a big, expansive place.
Yeah.
And that's kind of... that feels deliberate, of like, there's no boundaries here.
Exactly.
I mean, there are, but you can't see them.
It's like stepping into the real world. You know, it's him being forced to grow up and go, no, that safe space you knew about, that's not what the world is. The world is big and expansive and scary and delightful. You know, that you, as soon as you walk into Hyrule Field, you get that rising music. Oh, I'm excited. I want to go explore. Where am I going? But then if you linger too long, suddenly it turns to night.
God, I remember being terrified of the
exactly. It's
the
a great little thing, because it pushes you forward. It goes, you can explore as much as you want, but if you stay out here too long, things are going to get dangerous. So try and keep focus in a way.
You know what's interesting to me is that the environmental design of Zelda, like you said, it works really well. It is in step with the narrative. It's environmental storytelling.
Yeah.
But the way in which you receive plot is... it's actually kind of the thing that this podcast is named for. You walk up to somebody, you press A in this case, and they give you a text box and you scroll through it.
Yeah.
It's like, that is the most simple, I won't say laziest, but it's the most straightforward and basic way to tell a story in a game of like... here's a box, read this.
Yeah, but Zelda tends not to be overly verbose with that stuff.
Apart from if you talk to that owl.
Oh, yeah, no.
Apart from him.
His exposition dump owl, you know.
Yeah.
he's there to just throw some story at your face until you say no.
Or yes, by mistake, because it's confusing.
Exactly. But one of, like, that stepping out moment into Hyrule Field harkens back to that original Zelda of you have this whole world to explore, but be wary, it's dangerous to go alone. You know, you can't just walk anywhere. You can, and that's the great thing about it, is you can go anywhere, but you're going to find things you can't beat, or you're going to find things you don't know about, and they're going to be scary and dangerous. And that's why it works so well, I think.
Yeah, because that's what I mean. Like, the difference between, like, the environmental storytelling working in the way it does and just the... I guess, like, the info dumps that when you meet people, it's like one of these is much more elegantly designed than the other.
Yeah, it's like, it's the early days of video game storytelling. At some point, you need to contextualize stuff. You need to have a person tell you, this is Zelda, or this is that. And you can't always do that through environmental design or mechanics. No. It has to be done through some kind of direct storytelling. Just, here's some narrative, take it please.
What's interesting to me is that until very recently, and we'll talk more about this towards the end of the podcast, but the Zelda games never really evolved beyond that when it comes to storytelling. Like, when they want to tell you facts and figures and plot, they still do it in exactly the same way they did in Ocarina of Time. Like, Wind Waker did it the same, like Twilight Princess. I never played Skyward Sword, but I assume, like, I saw it was like same thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting to me because, like, or looking back on it, it feels like, oh, that's how we used to tell stories back then in game design. Game design was not so well advanced, and to an extent that's true, but then the Zelda games just didn't actually change how they told stories.
No, they kind of kept going. I mean, I think they evolved a bit more with the animation.
Yeah, the animation was better. So you got more sense of character from the people who you were talking to while reading this text box, but you still had a text box to read to tell you what was going on.
So, like, in a way, that they push forward that one aspect of, we want to give more emotion and more character to these characters, but we're still going to throw text boxes at you. You know, there's not much in a game. Like, there are ways to get around it, but without voice acting, you have to have text boxes. This isn't, you know, again, like Uncharted, where you can have Nathan Drake just talking whilst you're playing the game, because none of the characters have voiceover. You have to have some way to convey words. I don't know how that's going to change in the new one, because as we've seen with a few trailers, it's been voiceover in a Zelda game. What's going on? So we'll see how that goes. But one other bit of environmental storytelling that I think is really, really big in Ocarina of Time is that transition of to adulthood, and specifically around Hyrule Market.
Oh yeah,
because that is the biggest shift change in, like, you know, you're as a kid, Link. You know, Hyrule Market is this busy, bustling like town. Everyone's happy. They're dancing. They're singing. They're trading. And it's bright, it's really, really bright. There are lots of primary colours and white. You know, it feels very bustling and happy. And then you wake up as an adult, walk outside, and oh no. Suddenly it's purples and, you know, purples and blacks are the colours you're seeing, and browns. You walk out into the market and zombies screaming at your face.
Yeah, that's like, not good.
It's a huge shift change. And it really, really hammers home what has happened in the time. Like, just walking out into that market, you know, things are bad here. Things have gone wrong. So that transition, that big shift change is, you know, a masterful use of environmental storytelling, because you don't need any words. There's no text when you walk into Hyrule Market and go, oh, what happened here? You know things are bad.
It's interesting you say that, because the cutscene before that, when you pull the sword out in Temple of Time and the sage talks to you in the, like, whatever the realm you're in, that's a long cutscene of like text boxes and text boxes, but like you said, if you just look at the environmental story, that's kind of the thing. Looking back on it, it's somewhat frustrating, because, like, you have this good, really good environmental design, and then occasionally there'll be a long scroll you have to get through. Like, come on,
exactly.
Get to the point.
And I mean, like, that's the great thing of, you know, you've gone through this huge long cutscene of, you know, going into the Temple of Time and Gandalf stealing the Triforce and waking up as an adult, and now, okay, you just need to go out into the world and see what's going on and figure it out, and no one's going to be there to hold your hand anymore, because there is no one. You're alone, but you're an adult now. Deal with it. You know, and that's very, you know, it's that transition of, you know, Link walking around as a kid, everyone's like, oh, hi, little kid, what's going on? And then you wake up as an adult and there's like, no, like, we need help, please. Can you do something? Whereas, you know, when you're a kid, everyone's kind of like, oh, I don't really believe you can do much, but why don't you give it a go? Whereas when you're adult, everyone's going, can you help? Everything's on fire. Link's got adult problems to deal with now.
He's got to pay his rent. He's got a mortgage.
I know. the rates on those tree houses, they don't come cheap.
Yeah, it's
a lot of work, not, a lot of damp, rising damp.
What's interesting, I remember when you go back to Kokiri Forest as an adult, that's a really interesting thing, because nobody believes that you're Link, first of all, because Kokiri don't age. You know, you're not actually a Kokiri, you're Hylian, but they thought you were. So it feels like you go back and like, oh, I'm home again, but nobody knows who I am.
And there's a few more of the Deku Babas hanging around. It feels like strange and othering when you go back there. In a way, you want to tell them. You want to shout at them, I'm Link, don't you know? And they're like, nah, shut up. Big
you
man.
You can't be here. Yeah. It's when you mentioned like fairy tale stuff at the beginning, this is also kind of fairy tale, but it's more like, you know, not Disney fairy tales, more like Grimm fairy tales.
Mm. I mean, like, and this kind of comes on to another talking point I had about Zelda's storylines, is that it kind of harkens back almost to those really old school fantasy, the very first fantasy stories, the big travel narratives like the Odyssey and the Iliad and Gilgamesh, these epic tales of, you know, a hero and his journey through the world and how the world changes, but the hero, you know, changes with it. But that, you know, that storyline of Link going from a child to an adult and then the world changing and him having to deal with it, you know, he's exploring the world, but it changes halfway through and he gets to re-explore it again.
Yeah, it's kind of a compressed narrative because you do get literally a time skip when he pulls out the sword and it warps you to the future and you've aged. It's interesting because rather than that happen over time to Link, in the middle it just kind of cuts and like boom, it's the future now. It's kind of like in, this happens a lot of time in anime actually, like they'll do a time skip and like suddenly it's 10 years in the future and everyone's a lot older. You're like, whoa, hold on, slow down a second here.
And the good thing about that is that in Ocarina of Time, it's Link who's doing that. Link is going, whoa, I'm an adult now.
Again, like I said before, like Link and the player's experiences are very similar.
You experience the world through Link. And so his confusion of being an adult is your confusion. You're like, whoa, like, what happened here?
It feels very deliberate when you examine it, of like trying to keep Link and the player connected in that way.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's an important thing to keep that connection, because at every point, you know, you want the player to be experiencing the world as they explore it, finding those narrative bits and, you know, fully experiencing it, rather than in a lot of RPGs, you kind of wander around the world and then you go, oh, I'm going to just, you know, just skip through this guy's dialogue until he gives me the quest. And then, oh, I've got the quest mark, and now I'll go over here, kill the guy, right, hurry back. You know, you're completely ignoring the story half the time.
Yeah, I mean, I think that comes down to, like, personal preference a lot of the time.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Because, not to deviate from Zelda, but if you look at, like, another RPG, like the Elder Scrolls series, I played a bunch of Oblivion and never did the main quest.
Yeah.
So I was just like, I don't have to do this, I'm going to ignore it, I'm going to do everything else.
Yeah. And I mean, you can ignore the main quest in Zelda, absolutely. But you can't advance as a character.
Yeah.
Link doesn't level up. The way you're leveling up in the Zelda game is gaining items, in a way.
Yeah, it's actually, now you mentioned that, I don't think Zelda games have ever really had like a leveling system.
No, I mean, you could maybe see the heart pieces as a bit of a leveling system.
I guess so, yeah.
But even then, you're having to explore the world and do, like, you know, complete a challenge or, you know, find a secret area in a dungeon to get those heart pieces.
Do you think then that contributes to Link, you know, you feel like the same character, like it reinforces Link's character?
Yeah.
Because you're not buffing his stats, which is like an abstract thing.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, the only thing you do is more health and more magic.
Yeah.
But aside from that, you're not giving him more attack power. The way you give him more attack power is you get the Master Sword.
Yeah, you get the fire arrows, or Link is Link. Link doesn't change apart from being able to take more hits. And at any point, you know, you're not forced into that. You can skip every single heart piece and complete the game with 3 hearts.
Yeah.
If you're a sadist.
Yeah, or a speedrunner.
Yeah, exactly. Well, exactly. But the game never forces a change upon Link.
Oh, well, apart from the one time it does when you pull the sword out.
And that's a very important point to the narrative. So, of course
it
does.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And at any point, you can go back, stick the sword back in, and now you're
true.
A kid again.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the great thing about that game, is it doesn't stop you from experiencing the world the way you want to. It has a set, you need to do the dungeons in this order because this is the storyline, but you can, anything you've done before, just go back and have fun if you want to have a look, you know.
But what I was getting at is that it, because when you, in other RPGs, like I said, it's an abstract thing, and to tie this back to narrative, right, it's abstract, like I got XP from killing this dude, so I can put another point in my strength.
Yeah,
cool. It's non-diegetic, really. That's not part of the game.
It's not like plus one strength is like represented by a bigger muscle mass or something.
Yeah, but what that means is, in Ocarina of Time and Zelda games, that, because what I mean is, like, it's something abstract that you're doing to your character, which kind of increases that, like you said, ludonarrative, meaning, you know, gameplay and story, ludonarrative dissonance.
Mm.
Like, it increases that thing, so it's harder to relate. It's, like you said, it's more abstract things that you're thinking about as a player. In Ocarina of Time, it's like, oh, I found this better sword. So, of course, Link has the better sword. Like, it's in the game. Link picks it up and uses it, and it's better.
And at no point do you sit back and go, oh, the two is high. Three is better than two, but four could be better than one. You know, you're not sitting back and thinking about systems at any point.
You're not distracted by that, no.
That's a strength, I think, of Zelda, is that it keeps you within that game world as much as possible. Like, it's very good at cementing that game world, keeping you in it, keeping you immersed diegetically. And non-diegetically, you know, playing Zelda's fun. You have fun.
Yeah, it is. Exactly.
With the mechanics. You know,
it's not like trying to trap you in there. It's like, no, it's a fun game to play.
No, it's like, it's not like, for instance, like an adventure game where the gameplay might not be that. The moment-to-moment gameplay is you click on the screen.
Put the melon on the sousaphone to open the chest with the key in it.
So for them, they have to have a really good story to keep you immersed, or good puzzles. But in a Zelda game, just running around, hitting guys with your sword, using your bow, it's fun.
Hmm.
And that, that baseline fun gameplay is then put into a world that's immersive and a story that doesn't take you out at any point. It never says to you, I'm a game. Interact with me like a game and not like a story.
With games, the things that take you out of the story and remind you it's a game are things like, menu screens and so on, but... So we were talking a minute ago about like fairy tales and travel narratives and how like you mentioned the hero's journey.
Yes.
And that's a very well-known, very common. It's kind of the adventure story.
Yes.
Really.
Yeah. You look at Star Wars, it is the definition of the hero's journey. What the hero's journey is like a set of rules and kind of guidelines for how an adventure story should play out. You have a character, you have your character, you have a dispatcher, someone who sends the character on a quest, you have the call to action, which is the character being called on the journey, the refusal of the call, which is the thing of where the character goes, no, I don't want to leave. And then there's a whole section of like beats that the narrative hits in the hero's journey that a lot of stories hit. And that's all kind of based on a lot of kind of narrative theory back in the 20th century. But there's something I read up on when I was doing my degree of kind of almost before the hero's journey, I think, of this guy called Vladimir Propp. In 1928, he set out a treatise on folk and fairy tale story structure, narrative structure. And it's very much, again, that kind of hero's journey. But it focuses on the hero is struggling against the villain. These are the big capital letters hero, capital letters villain. Using items from donors on a quest from a dispatcher. And that's kind of your basic folk tale story structure.
Sure.
Link obviously being the hero, Ganondorf or Ganon being the villain. And in every aspect, Link, every time he goes to a dungeon, he's getting an item. Either from a donor or just from finding the item himself, and he's sent on this almost two separate quests by two separate dispatchers, the Deku Tree sending him out onto the world to go and see what's going on and go talk to Zelda, and then Zelda being the main dispatcher of we need to stop Ganondorf, you need to go find the spiritual stones, and we can then deal with this. And there's also this idea in Propp's fairy tale structure of the princess. Because it's a very, very, very common trope.
Yeah, it is. And, it's the princess, and usually the princess is in distress, has been captured, and that kind of thing.
The interesting thing about Zelda is that it takes that princess trope, and yes, it is there straight away. Zelda gets kidnapped, or she doesn't get kidnapped straight away. She's just in danger. And then Ganondorf takes over. And then, so in a lot of ways, right up until the end when Zelda is actually captured and you have to save her, the princess in Ocarina of Time is Hyrule.
Oh, so the princess as the thing you want to save.
The object of the quest is to save the princess. The princess in the tower, Zelda in Ocarina of Time only really gets locked up in a tower at the end. Up until that point, she is in hiding and then comes out into the story as Sheik, and is an active agent in the world, helping you along in your quest. she's giving you items. Well, she gives you items, but she's giving you the songs that help you travel around the world. And so, in a way, she's not a helpless princess in a tower. She is one of the agents acting with you to help you in your quest. The thing you're trying to save is the land itself, you know, Hyrule, because Ganondorf, that's what Ganondorf has stolen. He's not stolen the princess, he's stolen the kingdom.
Yeah, he took control, took power. What's interesting is, speaking about Zelda, the princess of Zelda, if you skip ahead to, like, Wind Waker, what they did with Zelda in that was, like, it was much more of, like, you have this character who is active, who is Tetra, rather. And then once you find out she's Zelda, she just stays in Hyrule and kind of just sits there.
Yeah, exactly. She's this, like, cool pirate captain.
Yeah.
With a lot of agency. And then
by the way, you're secretly Princess Zelda.
Yeah.
Just sit here for the rest of the game.
It's kind of a trope in Zelda games since Ocarina of Time, in that, you know, in Ocarina of Time, you have this character of Sheik, and then at the end, when it's revealed that Sheik is Zelda, suddenly Zelda gets captured by Ganondorf and you have to go and stop him. It's this kind of, like, as soon as Zelda becomes Zelda again, she loses all agency. And then you have to go save her, and then she gets some agency right at the end, like in Wind Waker, when she's shooting the light arrows, which is kind of her thing. It's like, they just turned her into, like, I'll shoot light arrows. That's her thing.
Yeah, in most games, like, that's also the thing of, like, so the story of, and that journey, that, you know, basic story and premise of Ocarina of Time that you were talking about, that is used in Ocarina of Time. Ocarina of Time is the blueprint for every 3D Zelda game that has come after it. Certainly in terms of story.
I mean, they've definitely changed things around. Like, you look at the next game, Majora's Mask, they changed things around mechanically and storyline. They played with it a lot, but at the end of the day, you're still taking some beats from Ocarina of Time, and they'll go back to it. Every time they'll go back to it and take things from it. And one thing, and this gets back to my point on travel on the Odyssey, is that at its core, especially the 3D Zelda games, but even from the original, the story of Zelda is a travel narrative. It is like the Odyssey, you know, like these big epic tales. It is about a hero's journey through a land, through the world, his exploration of that. And that whilst there is a narrative element pushing forward at all times, you know, it be it in Zelda, you know, saving the princess or saving Hyrule from Ganondorf, every area, every dungeon is what you could think of as a micro narrative. You look at Jabba Jabba's Belly and the Zora's Kingdom in Ocarina of Time, you have the king, you have the princess in a completely separate context, you know, the princess.
Yeah, that's true.
Princess actually, yeah. Zora. You have this whole thing of save the princess from, like, you know, this danger, and at the end, the character is rewarded with marriage. Not that Link wants marriage.
No,
he's very much
against it.
Well, I'm not ready to settle down here. Like,
that's right, I didn't sign up for this. Well, what's interesting is that he goes there to Jabba Jabba's Belly. Like, the reason he's there is to get the spiritual stone, the sapphire. And then there's this other narrative that's happening in the rest of it with the Zoras.
Yeah.
And he's like, well, okay, I guess I'll
do this. Suddenly he becomes part of the narrative and he joins that storyline. And there's a little storyline. It gets resolved. And then he goes back to the main narrative of where do I go next to get to my end goal. And, you know, at every point there's these little stories.
The same thing with the Goron temple as well. Like, you know, you go there for the spiritual stone and they're like, well, there's this big lizard guy in the volcano that's causing us a lot of problems.
Like, we're starving, we're getting hungry, we can't get food. So-and-so's gone in there to try and, like, stop it. There's, you know, there's these whole storylines that are devoid, you know, they are part of the main quest because it's all caused by Ganondorf. Yeah. But they are individual in their stories, you know. It's not like something in like a Deus Ex game where you're like, I need to get to the bottom of the conspiracy. Okay, the next part of the conspiracy is here, and then here, and then here, and you're going from place to place finding bits of the conspiracy.
Yeah, and like you have side missions, but they are explicitly, like, and non-diegetically, like, in your menu, they are a side mission. It tells you, like, this is not part of the main story, this is something else.
Whereas in Zelda, it's all part of the main story, but it feels separate, and you get to learn about that part of the world and those people in it as a separate story, and then you get invested with it, you complete it, and then you get the item that is, you know, essentially a level up for Link. You know, now I've got, you know, this item that lets me do something different.
Like a boomerang or a like, hook shot.
Or the Goron bracelet, so I can lift heavy things. You know, there's all these, you know, gameplay tropes of you go to the place, you get a new item, and you level up, in a way. But Zelda frames it in this travel narrative, this journey through the land of Hyrule, and all these different facets of Hyrule and places in it that have their own stories, their own communities, their own cultures and races. Mm. And that's why I think it is a worthy comparison to make. You know, even if it seems a bit like high concept, you know, talking about Homer's Odyssey in relation to Ocarina of Time and Zelda. I'm not saying they're literally like, you know, you can go and say, oh, this is the classic, but there's a reason why Ocarina of Time is highly regarded in video games. It's because it nails that that feeling of a travel narrative, of exploring a world and finding the stories within it.
And it was really one of the first 3D adventure, like RPG, whatever, adventure games. Not adventure games.
Action adventure game.
So yes, it was one of the first ones to do that. So, you know, it, again, not to get all, you know, like we said, pontificating about it, but even if it's not your favorite Zelda game, it is undoubtedly one of the most influential Zelda games, and kind of one of the more influential games, period.
Absolutely,
you know,
yeah.
Because of how it presented that, like you said, yeah. I'm thinking, like, all the time I'm thinking of, like, comparisons to, like, the Dark Souls series, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of like a modern, slightly different take, but is very much inspired by those kind of games, like Zelda.
Yeah, a focus on environmental storytelling and a travel through a world.
Yeah, travel narrative.
You know, and, like, a focus on exploration, you know, like, especially in Dark Souls 1 and 3, where they're a bit less linear and you kind of find places as you go. You know, you can wander down to somewhere you shouldn't be.
But yeah, they really take that element of exploration and just dial it up.
Yeah.
And actually, the funny thing is, and there's a good chance I'll do something about Dark Souls on this podcast in the future, but like, they dial it up at the expense of a straightforward narrative.
Yeah, yeah.
And Zelda is very much, here's our linear narrative. I don't think any Zelda game has any Zelda games ever really had like a branching paths kind of thing?
I mean, the only thing I can think of in terms of that would be the most recent one, A Link Between Worlds, where you have the item shop as the way in which you get your level up items. You know, the way you get the bow or you get the boomerang from the guy who has invaded your home and set up shop in there. He's just started selling stuff out of your house. That means you can do the dungeons in whatever order you choose.
Okay.
Which goes back to the original Zelda. In the original Zelda, there was no gating apart from, oh, you can't do this because you don't have the bombs, or you can't do this because you don't have this item. Mm. And, you know, there's a good way to do it in order, but you can still go to that dungeon. Even though you haven't done that one, you can still go in there and try it. You might not be able to finish it. But what A Link Between Worlds did is expand on that and say, okay, you found that dungeon. It needs the bow. You've got the boomerang, but the guy is selling the bow. So just go get enough money, go get the bow, and you can do that dungeon. And that lets you experience the narrative not out of order, because the dungeons in A Link Between Worlds are less micro-narrative based.
Right.
They're more similar to, you know, a link to the Past, obviously, because it's a direct sequel.
Yep.
But they're more focused on, you know, mechanical and gameplay elements rather than trying to tell a micro story within them. So it makes sense that you can kind of do them in any order, because it doesn't matter what order they happen in the story, as long as they happen. And then the story happens outside of them in the kind of like the end dungeons and like the focused bits.
But there's also, I mean, like, I was thinking also in terms of, like, your ending. The ending for the games it's not like a Mass Effect or like a anything where it's like, you don't get to choose. Although I think the closest you can get is in, I think, Majora's Mask. There are lots of little side quests that you have to do over the 3 days when they repeat. And you can just mess them up if you don't do it right.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, somebody's shop may not stay open when you finish the end, but the larger story still happens in the same way.
Yes. And, like, Majora's Mask plays with all these things in many, many different ways of, like, you're doing things out of order because the entire world is out of order. You know, the world doesn't work chronologically.
You're out of
anymore.
Order. This whole world is out of order.
Yeah.
Time's out of order.
It doesn't you know, work in Majora's Mask so much because it's playing with all these ideas a lot. And that's kind of to its benefit as well. It's it's not just Ocarina of Time 2.
No.
it's very much its own game. As much as some people like it, some people don't, it does new things, and that's a good thing in a series this long, is that we have so many different styles of games. You know, Wind Waker has a lot of exploration. Like,
it was so much based on exploration. Yeah.
Almost to its detriment, because some of the exploration wasn't very fun.
No, just like sailing around the sea for ages. It's telling that in the HD re-release for Wii U, they gave you a sail faster button.
Yeah, exactly, because they knew.
They had figured it out by then. They're like, yeah, this is taking too long.
But again, it had those travel narratives, those micro-narratives of you go to to Dragon Roost Island, and there's this whole storyline with the Rito and the dragon.
I mean, it's much more explicit about being a travel narrative as well.
Yes.
Because, I mean, as explicit as it is in Ocarina of Time, when you know, go over the bridge, leave the village that nobody's supposed to leave, it's even more directly linked to travel in Wind Waker, because you get on a boat, and that's something you immediately associate with travel.
Yeah.
You know, you're traveling to other places on a boat, right? You know.
And it's that sense of exploration is so exhilarating when you first get on that boat, go, oh, I can go anywhere. And then you go to an island and there's a chest on it, and you go, okay, cool. The story is very concentrated on a few islands.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas you look at the next game, Twilight Princess, it feels more linear, because I think they took the feedback of there was too much open world in Wind Waker, and they focused it more. And I think that it works to make a solid story, but in some ways they were still trying to get the most out of it, and it didn't fit as well.
So let's actually talk. One thing we wanted to talk about was, you mentioned, like, it's doing Ocarina of Time, like, was a big expansion of what a game could be like, a Zelda game could be, and it reinvented a lot of stuff, including, like, very specific, like, Hyrule as a whole.
Yeah,
because it was just like suddenly now you have this big open world stretching down in front of you. Actually, you know what's interesting? I was just thinking about this. Is that from a narrative point of view, right? Or just from the fact that it's a 3D game and not a top-down one, you have a horizon now.
Yeah, exactly. Suddenly you're going, what's over there?
Yeah, because you can see it. Yeah, you can see it in the distance and be like, I want to go look at that thing.
As opposed to, you know, in Link to the Past, you go, this is the screen, I can see everything on here.
Yeah, you can't see anything beyond that, so you can't look, you know, at the next one over the hill. Just by being a 3D game, it does actually give you that more direct sense of exploration by having a large horizon with things on it that you want to go look at.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of things in games about, like we said, like making sure that the player's experience and the narrative that you have as a player that you make of, like, oh, I went over here and I looked at this thing, is connected to the character.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's not a separate thing. Which some games do that, you know, where they'll have, you know, the characters will say, will feel one way or express some feeling that didn't come from you.
No, exactly.
It came from the writing. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
You know,
it's just, it's a more careful balance then. You know, you have to make sure that the player feels that makes sense for that character to feel that way. Whereas in a Zelda game, it makes sense because you're feeling that as well.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, I was just, you know, looking here at some screenshots, and there's a picture of Hyrule Field, and in the distance you can see Death Mountain with the smoke ring above it, and that's on the horizon. And so for a new player, like, stepping out into this world, you're like, what's that? I want to see what that is.
And it's like, you see the ranch over in the corner,
you
know, you come over the crest of the hill, and there's, you know, Hyrule Castle in the distance, and you're like, oh, I've got all these places I want to go visit.
And you can.
Yeah, exactly. You might not be able to advance straight through. You might go, you know, you go to Kirioka Village, and the guy tells you, come back with, you know, a warrant from Zelda. and you go, all right, mate. And then you go off and you go back to Hyrule. You know, there is a progression, you know, a linear progression, but you at no point are, you know, cemented into that progression. You can go and experience the world however you want. You know, it's not a corridor.
No. Like, so I know we're talking about exploration, but that is a narrative device, right? That is a way to just present the story. And so you, like you said, it's a travel narrative.
Yeah.
And so to give someone a horizon that they can decide where to go,
mm-hmm.
it reinforces that feeling of traveling and strengthens that connection to the character so that you don't feel removed from the game.
Yeah. It's not, you know, it's not that you've been put on this path and you have no control over where the path, where you go on that path. You have full control of where Link goes at any point in time. Whether or not you can go through a gate or go into a dungeon is dependent on the gameplay, but it's not like, you know, you get on a ship and the ship takes you to the place and you're stuck on that ship. You can't choose where it goes. At any point, you can, you know, when you're an adult Link, you get on the horse, you go wherever you want. And, you know, whether or not you can get across that gap or jump over that fence, that's up to, you know, your progress through the game. But you're not stuck on one road.
Yeah, you don't have anyone saying like, no, we can't go that way. We have to go this way.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know,
there's no invisible wall saying, no, you're going away from the story. Stay here.
Yeah. So, and that's important to keep players invested, right? That's, if that happens too much, then it feels like the game is getting in the way of what you want to do.
Exactly.
And so suddenly you don't care about this story anymore because the story is butting heads with your playing, with your playstyle.
Yeah, the game's getting in the way of the story you're trying to experience. You want to see what's over in that corner of the world. It could be nothing, but you want to go and see what it is. And the game's saying, no, that's not important.
Don't look at that. Don't go over there.
And from my perspective, it's like, well, if it's not important, don't show it to me. Don't offer it up to me as somewhere that I could go over to and travel to. If it's not important, cut it out.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of, they got a little bit away from that in Twilight Princess, it felt a little bit more like, oh, there's nothing over there, or they're showing you places you can't go.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're kind of getting back to that, and it kind of gets on to why I'm so excited for Breath of the Wild, is because the first time they showed it and talked about it, it was like, oh my god, yes. Fully open world Zelda with enhanced gameplay.
Yep.
All this stuff, but just the size of the world, the size of the open world, give me it.
It's also interesting that the few bits they've shown of the character of the Link in this game is that something happened and they were sealed away for 100 years.
Yeah.
Again, very kind of similar to Ocarina of Time.
Yeah.
Like, you know, they wake up and suddenly everything's changed. But it seems like Link seems to have some kind of amnesia.
Yeah.
So you and, again, like, it's that connection. You and Link will be exploring things and finding things out at the same time.
Yeah. It's not like Link knows what he's doing and you don't know until he tells you or to someone. Like, Link doesn't know. Link is exploring. And so are you. You experience everything that he experiences for the first time.
Well, that's an interesting thing, actually, that makes me think of then, like, in other games where you have characters who are very defined characters, something they do outside of your control will tell you something about them.
Yes.
But compared to Link, somebody else will say something to you about you. That's the difference. Like, just in talking about it, the language you use to talk about it.
Yeah.
It's like the character will say something that tells you something about them.
Yeah.
Rather than another character tells you what, something about you.
Yeah, you have an experience.
It's you, not them.
Exactly.
Like, that's the connection we were talking about. Like I said, there's nothing wrong with, you know, having, like, defined characters who have their own traits independent of the character of the player are perfectly fine, and there are so many really good examples. But it can be hard sometimes to keep that connection between player and character when they're doing something that you didn't put into them.
You know, it's that kind of thing of, like, you're playing through a game and then you hit a cutscene and then the character does something that you're like, no, what are you doing? Like, it's like, you know, the control of the action is taken away from you and suddenly you don't feel in control.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, cutscenes are a way of taking control away from the player, and they're fine when they're used like that properly, because you look in Zelda, that cutscene where Ganondorf comes over the bridge and you see Princess Zelda, you know, being taken away, you shouldn't have control there because you can't do anything. You're a little kid, there's Ganondorf.
Yeah.
Like, you need to see this happen, and it's very disempowering, and that's the point of it, is that Link had no power over what happened. He needs to go and get that power to stop it. Whereas, you know, for instance, you were given an option of do you do this or that, and you go through and you think, oh, I'm going to do this, and then suddenly you hit a cutscene and Link does something stupid or something you wouldn't do, that's where it falls apart. That's where you feel disconnected from the story and the characters again. So Breath of the Wild, just like...
Yeah, let's get back onto that just for a sec, because...
One thing I'm excited as well is, because of how the size of the world, it allows more space for in-depth micro-narratives, like I was talking about before, though. Each dungeon, each area has its own story. Because the areas are bigger, that allows for more in-depth storytelling within those. And we haven't seen many of them yet, because, it's not...
No,
out.
It's...
But I'm excited to get into those spaces and play around in them and see where they take you.
Well, what's interesting is just from the demos and previews, we've seen a ruined temple, which, many people think is that the Temple of Time or whatever.
Exactly.
But it's ruined, and there are these strange-looking machines or monsters that are rusted in the ground around it. And already, just from that, that's a little micro-narrative right there, environmental storytelling of, like, okay, these things have been here a long time, they're covered in moss, and they attacked this place and destroyed it, something used to be here. And like that, even just that, like that's a little micro narrative and environmental storytelling.
Yeah, exactly.
Just from that preview.
And it gives you that little hint that you wanna explore more, you wanna go, what's going on with these guys? You wanna find out the mystery of what happened to Hyrule. Why are these things here? Why is this all destroyed? And Link wants to as well. The character wants to find out.
Yeah, because he's just woken up and has no idea where he is or who he is. It's like, I'm there. Although, again, interestingly, in the previews for Breath of the Wild, we've seen that it has the same text box-based storytelling as a lot of the previous games, but it also has voice acting.
Yes. I've never been opposed to it, because at the end of the day, a text box is just a reduction of someone talking.
Well, the problem with a text box... And again, like, this is something that you have to work around, and Ocarina of Time tries to, but I feel like it never did it that well, partly because of limitations of the time.
Yeah.
But it's hard to convey emotion. It's harder to convey emotion
through
a text box.
I mean, Zelda's relied on its increasingly better animation to convey convey all its emotion. And I don't think they're shying away from that at all. I mean, you look at the story trailer they just released with the Switch news. There was a lot of emotion in that story trailer
through the
animation, but also they're adding in the voice acting now, and that can really help push it forward and emphasize it in certain ways. Depending on how they use it, they could do it badly and it could take you out of it, but hopefully they use it sparingly enough that it doesn't feel tacked on, it doesn't feel like, oh, this one character has a voice but no one else does.
That's the thing, that's what worries me, because we've seen again like that it's a mix, because there's a bit where he's talking to the old man in all the gameplay previews
have had,
and it's a text box and you scroll through it as normal, but in the trailer it's like a lot of voice acting, a lot of that, and you think, well, is it going to do one, the other, or is it going to do both? And if it does both, it's going to be weird that some people have a voice and other people don't.
See, I'm already getting a few feelings of it through just from those initial gameplay demos. You watch that first one where Link's waking up in the blue tub of juice from his cryogenic sleep chamber.
Cryosleep, yeah.
Yeah, but you get some voice over there. You get a bit of Zelda talking. I presume it's Zelda. I don't know. It's a female voice.
We don't know.
It's a female voice. But I feel like because there's been that 100-year time skip, there's going to be some distinction between the person that sent you on this quest and put you in the cryosleep chamber versus the characters in the world at the moment. Because I am assuming that the actual Zelda that you're going to be interacting with is not the same one, if there was one, that sent you on the quest in the first place.
Or it may have been somebody else entirely who sent you on the quest.
Yes, but if you look at it, you think like 100 years ago in Hyrule there would have been a king, there would have been maybe another Princess Zelda 100 years beforehand. And what I'm thinking is they may be doing something with the voiceover being those characters from the past and the characters in the world not having a voice. So you're never taken aback by this one character talking, but this other one not, because the only voices you're getting are, you know, ghosts from the past. We'll see how it plays out.
Oh, yeah, that could be interesting. I mean, we're speculating, but that could be... I was kind of thinking of it the other way, in that if they wanted to kind of be meta about it, people from the past speak with text boxes, and people from the current timeline speak with voices, because that's how games have evolved.
Oh, maybe. I mean, I'd be interested to see where they take it. At the end of the day, if they go full voice acting, I've got nothing against that.
No. To be honest, at the time Ocarina of Time came out, it wasn't really a throwback. It was still, a lot of games still did that. You had games more late, like, that were around the same time, things like Metal Gear. Other games that used, like, voice acting.
Yeah.
But, like, a text-based thing was still kind of... Like, you look at Banjo-Kazooie. That had text, but it was like...
I mean, their voices were just little sounds to go to, like, look at the animal talking, but it wasn't a full voice. There wasn't, like, someone reading through a dialogue sheet.
Yeah. But now, as Zelda games went on and kept doing that, it became more and more... archaic, I guess.
Yeah,
you're like, it's 2000 and it's like, whenever Twilight Princess comes out, it's like 2000 and whatever. This is, why are we still doing it this way?
Yeah, and like, you got bits here and there, not of full voice acting, but characters start made more sounds,
just like ah, oh,
exactly.
Oh,
what? But yeah, like, I'm excited to see where they take it, because it could add a lot. If done correctly, it could add a whole lot more to the storytelling. Not that it ever needed it, but as seen before, but it could bring it, because this whole game feels fresh, feels new. I mean, you look at, you know, you've got cooking and food, you've got survival game elements like the temperature meter. Yeah,
it really seems like they're picking up a lot of stuff from games that they have never done before, like different equipment and different equip slots and, you know...
Damage on weapons, like...
You have a stamina bar.
Yeah.
You have a stamina meter, like, that's... They've never done that before.
And in a lot of, like, conversations about it, Eiji Onanuma has been talking about going back to the original Zelda, the very, very first game, and looking at the ideas it put forward... Not necessarily the game itself, but, you know, just that picture from the booklet of Link standing looking at the expansive world, and they go, we want to emulate what that would feel like now. And it means they have to take Zelda back and rethink a lot of the mechanics. You know, you add in a stamina meter, add in, like, oh, bombs are now made of magic, and, you know, we're talking about, you know, different temperatures and clothing on Link and how he can survive in the wild. But that also informs the story of Link travelling through this wild land and trying to survive as part of his journey. You know, he's not some kid anymore that can wake up in his treehouse every morning and get back to work, like in Ocarina of Time. Link is in the wild. It's Breath of the Wild. It's in the title of the game. And that's enhanced by the fact that you have to cook food. You have to keep track of how hot or cold you are. And that's interesting, and I'm excited to get that feeling baked into Zelda now. Whereas before, you felt kind of a little bit invincible. You know, you could walk around for days and never have to do anything. whereas I don't think they're putting hunger in the game, but, you know, the food is there to replenish health. It's there to give you buffs. There's a reason for you to do it, and it makes it feel more like a travel, more like a journey, because he's sitting down at a campfire.
Well, what's interesting to me is that a lot of the games that do have, like, travel narratives, and it's when you compare yourself at the end to yourself at the beginning. And for Link, in Ocarina of Time, Link at the beginning, he's a kid, he doesn't have a sword, he doesn't have a shield, and you pick that up fairly quickly, you get a Deku sword, Deku shield. At the end, you're an adult. If you might be wearing a different coloured tunic, you could be wearing the red or blue one, or you might just be wearing the green one, but you're an adult, you've got the Master Sword, you've got the Hylian Shield, or you've got the Mirror Shield, and it's like, you compare, like, wow, I've come so far from where I was. But in that, it's a difference. Mostly the biggest difference is age.
Yes.
Which you compare, I can see Breath of the Wild being like, you start out with no clothes. You know, you have to get some more. And they're very obvious, they're very clearly doing, like, the... what is now kind of a standard RPG thing of like, here's a terrible shirt, look, here's a slightly better one. Oh, I'll put that one on, you know. So by the end you're going to have a completely different set of gear, and it's going to be noticeable that the character you are at the end is not the same character you started out as, you know. Think you've changed. And that's actually something that they've, I think that Breath of the Wild looks like it will be able to do better than Ocarina of Time.
Yeah.
Because of that kind of system.
For sure. There's one thing as well, is that Zelda games have never really had much emergent gameplay in them.
Not really, no. There's kind of, because like you said, of how linear a lot of them are.
Yeah, yeah. You go in the dungeon, that's the dungeon, you know. If there's enemies out in the world, they're just hanging out and you go and kill them. Whereas they seem to be really doubling down on, oh, you know, look at, you know, they've clearly looked at previous open world games like Skyrim, like The Witcher, those kind of games where the world feels a bit more alive and a bit more lived in, and things are happening in that world, and you can interact with them in a multitude of different ways. I think that's really going to tie into the feeling of having some control over the narrative and the story, because you have control over the gameplay more. You have more agency to do different things. So, for instance, I was listening to a podcast from Waypoint.vice.com, okay. And they were talking about how during one of the Switch demos they were playing of Zelda, there was this big area of like long grass, and out in the distance there was like a big warthog in the middle of this big field. And it just felt natural to him to walk slowly through that long grass. Not because of any kind of gameplay reason, other than it just felt right to do it. Because it fit with the feeling that of that land. And, you know, the fact that you could, if you wanted to, crouch down in that long grass. And then you're stealthed. And there's a stealth mechanic in the game now, where you can hide from characters, because you might want to be hunting that boar. You know, and suddenly you have all these different things of, you don't have to play it this way. You can just run straight through that and go and explore, you know, just run straight through it, hit the thing with a sword or whatever. Or, oh, there's this ruined guy, this ruined robot thing in the ground. You can go over there or you can leave him alone. But if you go over there and you explore it, you might activate it, and now you've got to have a fight. And suddenly these bits of emergent gameplay start happening that inform the kind of story that you're forming in your head. Is Link a careful hunter, or is he just a brazen, I need to kill something? You know, that's, you're given more agency.
Mm.
You're given more ability to inform those decisions.
So that's going to be interesting to see how they do with Breath of the Wild.
Mm.
So to just, you know, to tie this back to Ocarina of Time, like we said, like, things have changed a lot since Ocarina of Time came out. Games have evolved since then, and it seems like now Breath of the Wild is taking some of those lessons learned, but from its own, in its historical context,
yes,
I guess you could say, Ocarina of Time was a big shift, and there's a reason it's very fondly remembered. I think it's not just nostalgia. There's a lot to like about the game. Like,
absolutely,
graphically, you know, maybe it doesn't hold up these days, but you have the HD re-releases, you have the Master Quest version, you have the 3DS re-release, and a lot of it is because, like you said, of that story, which is the overall story is a fairly simple one, but it tells it well.
It tells it well, and it does interesting things with that very simple story of save the princess, save the kingdom. It plays around with it enough to make it interesting. You've got that time jump, you've got exploring the world as a kid and versus exploring the world as an adult, and you get to revisit things, and it's, you know, there are tropes in there, but the world is interesting and new enough that you want to find out what's going on and you want to see the new places. Because it's not just like Lord of the Rings ripoff, you know.
Yeah.
It's not just, oh, there's elves and dwarfs. What are the elves up to? They're being in the forest. What are the dwarfs up to? They're in the mountains. Like, you have analogues, you know, the Gorons and the Kikiri, but they're different.
Yeah,
they're their own beasts.
One thing that I find interesting about just about the overall story that you go on this adventure, you go to get the Master Sword, you grab the Master Sword, you're transported 7 years into the future. You see what happens when Gandalf takes over. It's kind of like a reminder of like, right, this is why you need to fight, because you need to stop this from happening.
Yeah, exactly. It's like you get to see the consequences of your failure.
Actually, yeah, you get to see the bad end.
Yeah, and then you get to go back and fix it.
We have to go back, Marty.
We gotta go back. Yeah, but and that's really interesting of you get to see what happens when you fail and then fight your way through it to get the chance to do right by it.
Yeah, because like when you fight Ganon as an adult with the final battle, you fight Ganon as an adult and you defeat him, but the end of the game, it kind of warps you back in time to being a kid again.
Yeah, that final shot is of Link and Zelda as kids again, meeting again.
Yeah, because I try to remember, but they use the Triforce to, you know, save stuff.
So Link defeats Ganon, and then everything is kind of like going crazy, and they get together with the Triforce, Zelda and Link, and they go, we're going to use this to send you back in time, because Link needs to go, or they use the Ocarina of Time one last time to send you back to fix everything that's been broken. It's the idea of, you know now what you have to do. You've defeated Ganon in this timeline, so you go back and get to be a kid again. Because the whole thing of it is, you missed 7 years of your life, whereas Zelda didn't. Zelda experienced it.
Yeah.
So she feels bad for Link, and she wants to give him back his childhood.
Well, it's interesting that your reward is childhood.
Yeah, exactly. Your reward is to get to go back and enjoy your childhood in peace. And as much as, you know, Link doesn't do that because he then goes off into Termina there's all that
Majora's Mask and
But the reward is going back and stopping the bad thing from happening in the first place and getting to have your life back.
Yeah, and just one other thing is that also reminds me, because we talked about fairy tales, that there's similar kind of fairy tales where it's like a kid will, it's kind of like the never ending story where like the kid, he goes on this adventure and then gets kicked back to the real world at the end.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's kind of like a dream, but it's not, and it's real. That's similar to how Ocarina of Time ends, really.
Yeah.
That it's an alternate future that Link gets thrown into and has to prevent from happening, and then he goes back to being a kid again.
Well, it's not that even he prevents it from happening, he fixes the alternate future.
He fixes it, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
But the idea is, like, it's kind of like this alternate thing, almost like a dream world, that then he comes back to at the end to be a kid again.
Yeah, and there is that kind of emotional moment of the, like, Zelda saying goodbye to Link, because those two adult characters won't get to meet again. Like, Zelda's going to be different when you go back as a kid, and there is that moment of, like, this has been great, but you need to go back home.
It's a bittersweet end.
Exactly,
really.
Yeah. But then you go back and you get to have your childhood that you never had. So yeah, it is that kind of interesting story. You know, it could have just ended as, you save the kingdom, now you get to marry the princess and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And it doesn't do that. It doesn't just end with the trope. It goes, no, you've experienced this story as Link. Now Link needs to get his life back.
It's kind of like the plot or the narrative of Ocarina of Time is, you know, it's the destruction or removal of naivety from Link as a child.
Yeah.
And just suddenly it's like, no, here's the real world. And, oh, look, here's the really bad stuff. And then the sort of fantastical ending is that he gets to have that back.
Well, and the interesting thing is, though, that I don't necessarily see it as him being given back his naivety. He's just being given back the time he lost to enjoy that naivety.
You imagine Link's just kind of like, I've seen things, man.
Well, you look at Majora's Mask, the Link in that is not a child anymore. You know, he's still like, you know, I think he's supposed to be 14 or something in that
game.
But he's not the child that you see at the beginning of Ocarina of Time, but doesn't know what he's doing and he's scared. The Link in Majora's Mask is a bit more kind of badass. He's a bit more of a hero because he's already done. He knows how to fight.
Yeah.
You know, the first thing you do in Majora's Mask is you're running through the forest and he's doing backflips and he's doing somersaults that you never saw in the original game, because suddenly Link is like, he's that adventurous hero because he's already done it, and he comes back and he's like, right, I know how to do this stuff. This is my life now. Like, I get to choose where I go and things are a bit better, but I've gained some knowledge and I've gained some agency.
So yeah, like there's a lot you can pick apart from Ocarina of Time. It's
it is a reason why it's been consistently lauded as one of the best games ever. Like,
yeah,
as much as some people have nostalgia for other Zeldas, you know, for some people it's a Link to the Past, other people Ocarina of Time, for people newer it might be Wind Waker, but
yeah.
There is something about that game that it does just so well. And
yeah.
For them to nail it first time, you know,
in
a 3D Zelda.
Like, it changed the game, like, no pun intended. It was just like, right, we're going to really reinvent the wheel here because we have all this extra ability to do so because of the 3D engine, the Nintendo 64. And like we were saying, what's interesting is they didn't just seem to approach that from a gameplay perspective. They were like, how can we use this new ability of 3D rendering? How can we use this to tell our story?
Yeah, they didn't just take Zelda and put it up make it out of 3D bits, but keep the camera angle and keep the gameplay.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's just like, you know, you look at Nintendo at the time, they were doing the exact same thing with Mario. They could have just made a side-scrolling Mario game, but they were like, no, we've got all this, we've got a whole extra dimension to work with. How do we make the best thing in this space? And it involves changing it up a lot, but Nintendo at the time were just nailing it. They were just hitting that nail on the head. And, you know, Ocarina of Time is a show of force of that, of someone has, they had the right idea of where to take it and what to do with it. And they had the power to do more with it. Suddenly they had all this extra processing power and animation and all this stuff, and they really, really went for it, and they didn't hold back.
No, and like I said, it just seems like their design philosophy, just from how the game played, it just seems like it was story first.
Yes.
And then gameplay, but they didn't skimp on gameplay because it was fun to play, but it's like, we're trying to tell a story here, that's what's important.
Yeah.
Like, that is actually kind of the opposite of Mario, funnily enough.
Yeah, yeah.
Mario is very much like gameplay, and the plot and the story is kind of an excuse plot, really. Yeah.
Whereas with Zelda, the gameplay is informed by the story. The story sets up the reason why the gameplay can happen and keeps you getting more of it. You know, it's a reason why there's more gameplay is because of the story.
And, you know, that seems like a fairly straightforward thing nowadays because a lot of big games will do that. Like, that's how a lot of games work. Well, ones with a defined story, they work that way. But for the time, like, this was one of the first games to really try and do that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like we said, gaming is a young medium. It was developing then, it's still developing now.
Yes. Yeah, you've had your ups and your downs, you've had your successes and your failures, and there's a reason why Ocarina of Time is kind of looked at as that one of those huge early successes in whilst the medium was still young. It's because it knew what games could do, separate from movies and separate from what they'd been before.
Yes.
In the 2D era. Suddenly they had, you know, the whole world to play with, and they did, and they went for it, and they were like, what can we do with the combination of gameplay and story? You know, what can we do with exploration in a 3D space with a story, rather than sitting back and go, oh, let's just make a 3D Zelda.
Yeah, I feel like there's a good point to end on here, because we've touched on this a whole bunch, but, you know, they have cutscenes and they have that kind of stuff, but it's by... They do a good job of connecting the player to the character of Link.
Yes, absolutely.
More modern games, like something like, let's say, Last of Us. It very much feels at times, and Uncharted is like this as well, when you're watching a cutscene, you're watching a movie, it borrows from film.
Yes.
It doesn't take full advantage of the medium in which it is presented. It doesn't take full advantage of being a game. And I feel like Ocarina of Time and other Zelda games, but Ocarina of Time specifically, they take more advantage of the fact that it is a game.
Yeah.
And the games can do things that other mediums cannot do.
I mean, in what other medium could your main character never speak a word of dialogue and yet you still be invested in their story?
I mean, mimes, maybe.
the success of Zelda is the fact that people are invested in the character of Link and Zelda. You know, people love the character of Link, they love the story of Zelda, but he doesn't say a single word, and that's a kind of testament to how good the storytelling is in those games, is that you still get a strong narrative and a strong connection to the world without them needing to try and ape movies with cutscenes and this kind of thing.
I've really, like, Nintendo as a company, they seem to have their head in the game space and not trying to make things, like, it did make the game more cinematic moving to 3D, but they don't seem to be trying to borrow from cinema.
No, they know that games have their own strengths, and they want to they really love showing games what they can be. You look at the PlayStation era, there was a lot more of those games trying to be movies.
I mean, Metal Gear, the Metal Gear franchise is a perfect example of that.
I mean,
right?
Get Metal Gear 4 with a 90-minute cutscene.
Oh god, yeah, I mean, that's like the most blatant of, like, this is a film.
Yeah,
now.
But people still revere Kojima because those games are still fun to play, and you still have that similar connection to Snake and as you do to Link, of Snake's actions when you have control of them are Snake's actions. As a, you know, same with Link. So Nintendo really focused on that gameplay there. They really focused on keeping you in the world and keeping you immersed in that world. And they've always been good at that, I think. You know, I've always been interested in the worlds that Nintendo make and exploring them.
I mean, their consoles and other things sometimes leave things to be desired.
Their online services may have a few things that we might need to figure out.
That's a subject for another podcast.
Oh, just let me take out my phone and then put my headphones in my phone so I can do a voice.
Why? Mm. Okay. Anyway,
it's a good thing they make good single-player games.
They do. And that's really what we... getting that here is that, you know, the environmental storytelling, that connection to the character of Link,
mm-hmm. and the epic scope of the games,
and using epic in the more traditional sense of this is what a historical epic was like,
exactly,
not like LOL so epic.
You can have an epic that feels small. You can have Hyrule is not a big world in Ocarina of Time.
No, I mean, that's, again, limitations of the console.
Exactly.
But
it still feels epic. It still feels like a large narrative, even if the actual world is small. And that's a testament to the game design, to the environmental storytelling, and just the quality of it, the way it's made.
And so, and to wrap things up, like we said at the beginning of the show, we're not trying to say that Ocarina of Time is a perfect game. You know, we're not trying to say it's the best game ever. Or even that it's the best Zelda game ever, but it's certainly our favorite Zelda game.
I would say so, for sure. And it's something that I don't think we should ever forget in gaming history. I don't think it ever will be forgotten because it was such a seminal moment of games transitioning into the 3D space and really showing their full potential as storytelling devices. And Zelda was one of the first to really hit that. Hard and hit it well.
So there you go. There's a good thought to end on. So yeah, that was Press X for Story about Ocarina of Time and kind of, you know, Zelda as a whole and somewhat of a retrospective on the series so far. And looking ahead to Breath of the Wild.
Oh, absolutely.
So are you gonna get this Nintendo Switch?
I definitely want one. The price is going to be different. It's going to be an interesting thing.
We'll see how that goes.
Save the pennies, you know. Save the pennies.
Save up a little bit.
But I've always been someone who gets. Nintendo games are Nintendo games, so I'm always interested in playing them.
So yeah, we look forward to the future of Zelda games, and while also looking back at what's gone before, and yeah, so there you go. So yeah, we hope you enjoyed this episode of Press X for Story. This is one of the first ideas I had for this podcast, was like, get my brother on, because you've just heard, like, we will talk forever.
I can just keep going.
But we'll be here all day if we do.
Exactly.
But so, because I know, you know, you've studied this. You wrote a dissertation on this. It's like, perfect, get in here.
Exactly. I'm always up for an excuse to just keep talking about this stuff, because it's really interesting. It's why I got into games. It's why I got into game design and doing art, so... I'm always up for more conversations on narrative. I've got entire essays filled with this stuff.
So expect more of these. Expect a repeat appearance from Scott. So
well, it's been great being here. Like, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, like, no, I mean, it was nothing. It's like we're brothers, man. Come on, you're my brother.
Oh, yeah.
Bros. Yeah, this was a lot of fun, and we hope you enjoyed it. And if you do want to, if you have any thoughts about that, about this podcast, maybe you have some other things to add or whatever, do let us know. Send us a tweet or a comment on the podcast on the website, and also use hashtag PressX for Story, and we'll, yeah, just let us know what you think.
You can find me on Twitter at the Flaming Dude. I've got a blog that I've put together partly some of these thoughts I've put together on a couple of blog posts. So
you should do some more of those blog posts.
You can find them at scribbled-worlds.tumblr.com if you want to take a look at that. I've got some art and music that I put on there as well. So
yeah, it's good stuff.
Check it out, and yeah.
And as usual, you know where to find me on Twitter at @can'twearhats, and go to can'twearhats.co.uk for episodes of this podcast with links to RSS feeds. And there's all supported by the Patreon, patreon.com/can'twearhats.
Give this man your money.
Yes, please, I need to eat. No. No, it's what allows me to do this and the other podcasts and such. So once again, it's been really good having you on, and I'm sure we will have more stuff.
Oh, absolutely.
We'll crop up again. I'll bring you back on for something.
I look forward to it.
It might be the case that it's like, you know, nobody else wants to do anything this month. Hey, Scott, you got an idea about something? Yeah, let's talk about that.
Let me talk to you about my treaties on...
See, I've got a good resource here.
Exactly.
All right. So once again, thanks for listening and hope you enjoyed the show. And we'll be back again soon. No word on what the next episode will be, but follow on Twitter for updates and such. And we'll let you know when. But yeah, we'll see you soon. Goodbye. Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye. 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 Bye.